Chapter 3. Love and its Disintegration in Contemporary Western Society. If love is a capacity of the mature, productive character, it follows that the capacity to love in an individual living in any given culture depends on the influence this culture has on the character of the average person. If we speak about love in contemporary Western culture, we mean to ask whether the social structure of Western civilization and the spirit resulting from it are conducive to the development of love. To raise the question is to answer it in the negative. No objective observer of our Western life can doubt that love, brotherly love, motherly love, and erotic love, is a relatively rare phenomenon, and that its place is taken by a number of forms of pseudo-love which are in reality so many forms of the disintegration of love. Capitalistic society is based on the principle of political freedom on the one hand, and of the market as the regulator of all economic, hence social relations, on the other. The commodity market determines the conditions under which commodities are exchanged. The labor market regulates the acquisition and sale of labor. Both useful things and useful human energy and skill are transformed into commodities which are exchanged without the use of force and without fraud under the conditions of the market. Shoes, useful and needed as they may be, have no economic value, exchange value, if there is no demand for them on the market. Human energy and skill are without exchange value if there is no demand for them under existing market conditions. The owner of capital can buy labor and command it to work for the profitable investment of his capital. The owner of labor must sell it to capitalists under the existing market conditions unless he is to starve. This economic structure is reflected in a hierarchy of values. Capital commands labor. Amassed things, that which is dead, are of superior value to labor, to human powers, to that which is alive. This has been the basic structure of capitalism since its beginning, but while it is still characteristic of modern capitalism, a number of factors have changed which give contemporary capitalism its specific qualities and which have a profound influence on the character structure of modern man. As a result of the development of capitalism, we witness an ever-increasing process of centralization and concentration of capital. The large enterprises grow in size continuously. The smaller ones are squeezed out. The ownership of capital invested in these enterprises is more and more separated from the function of managing them. Hundreds of thousands of stockholders own the enterprise. The managerial bureaucracy, which is well paid but which does not own the enterprise, manages it. This bureaucracy is less interested in making maximum profits than in the expansion of the enterprise and in their own power. The increasing concentration of capital and the emergence of a powerful managerial bureaucracy are paralleled by the development of the labor movement. Through the unionization of labor, the individual worker does not have to bargain on the labor market by and for himself. He is united in big labor unions, also led by a powerful bureaucracy which represents him vis-a-vis the industrial colossi. The initiative has been shifted, for better or for worse, in the fields of capital as well as in those of labor, from the individual to the bureaucracy. An increasing number of people cease to be independent and become dependent on the managers of the great economic empires. Another decisive feature resulting from this concentration of capital and characteristic of modern capitalism lies in the specific way of the organization of work. Vastly centralized enterprises with a radical division of labor lead to an organization of work where the individual loses his individuality, where he becomes an expendable cog in the machine. The human problem of modern capitalism can be formulated in this way. Modern capitalism needs men who cooperate smoothly and in large numbers, who want to consume more and more, and whose tastes are standardized and can be easily influenced and anticipated. It needs men who feel free and independent, not subject to any authority or principle or conscience, yet willing to be commanded, to do what is expected of them, to fit into the social machine without friction, who can be guided without force, led without leaders, prompted without aim, except the one to make good, to be on the move, to function, to go ahead. What is the outcome? Modern man is alienated from himself, from his fellow men, and from nature. He has been transformed into a commodity, experiences his life forces as an investment which must bring him the maximum profit obtainable under existing market conditions. Human relations are essentially those of alienated automatons, each basing his security on staying close to the herd and not being different in thought, feeling, or action. While everybody tries to be as close as possible to the rest, everybody remains utterly alone, pervaded by the deep sense of insecurity, anxiety, and guilt which always results when human separateness cannot be overcome. our civilization offers many palliatives which help people to be consciously unaware of this aloneness. First of all, the strict routine of bureaucratized mechanical work, which helps people to remain unaware of their most fundamental human desires, of the longing for transcendence and unity. Inasmuch as the routine alone does not succeed in this, man overcomes his unconscious despair by the routine of amusement, the passive consumption of sounds and sights offered by the amusement industry. Furthermore, by the satisfaction of buying ever new things and soon exchanging them for others. Modern man is actually close to the picture Huxley describes in his Brave New World, well-fed, well-clad, satisfied sexually, yet without self, without any except the most superficial contact with his fellow men. Guided by the slogans which Huxley formulated so succinctly, such as, "When the individual feels, the community reels," or "Never put off till tomorrow the fun you can have today," or as the crowning statement, "Everybody is happy nowadays." Man's happiness today consists in having fun. Having fun lies in the satisfaction of consuming and taking in commodities, sights, food, drinks, cigarettes, people, lectures, books, movies. All are consumed, swallowed. The world is one great object for our appetite, a big apple, a big bottle, a big breast. We are the sucklers, the eternally expectant ones, the hopeful ones, and the eternally disappointed ones. Our character is geared to exchange and to receive, to barter and to consume. Everything, spiritual as well as material objects, become an object of exchange and of consumption. The situation as far as love is concerned corresponds, as it has to by necessity, to the social character of modern man. Automatons cannot love. They can exchange their personality packages and hope for a fair bargain. One of the most significant expressions of love, and especially of marriage with this alienated structure, is the idea of the team. In any number of articles on happy marriage, the ideal described is that of the smoothly functioning team. This description is not too different from the idea of a smoothly functioning employee. He should be reasonably independent, cooperative, tolerant, and at the same time ambitious and aggressive. Thus, the marriage counselor tells us the husband should understand his wife and be helpful. He should comment favorably on her new dress and on a tasty dish. She, in turn, should understand when he comes home tired and disgruntled. She should listen attentively when he talks about his business troubles, should not be angry but understanding when he forgets her birthday. All this kind of relationship amounts to is the well-oiled relationship between two persons who remain strangers all their lives, who never arrive at a central relationship, but who treat each other with courtesy and who attempt to make each other feel better. In this concept of love and marriage, the main emphasis is on finding a refuge from an otherwise unbearable sense of aloneness. In love, one has found, at last, a haven from aloneness. One forms an alliance of two against the world, and this egoism à deux is mistaken for love and intimacy. The emphasis on team spirit, mutual tolerance, and so forth, is a relatively recent development. It was preceded, in the years after the First World War, by a concept of love in which mutual sexual satisfaction was supposed to be the basis for satisfactory love relations, and especially for a happy marriage. It was believed that the reasons for the frequent unhappiness in marriage were to be found in that the marriage partners had not made a correct sexual adjustment. The reason for this fault was seen in the ignorance regarding correct sexual behavior, hence in the faulty sexual technique of one or both partners. In order to cure this fault and to help the unfortunate couples who could not love each other, many books gave instructions and counsel concerning the correct sexual behavior and promised implicitly or explicitly that happiness and love would follow. The underlying idea was that love is the child of sexual pleasure, and that if two people learn how to satisfy each other sexually, they will love each other. It fitted the general illusion of the time to assume that using the right techniques is the solution not only to technical problems of industrial production, but of all human problems as well. One ignored the fact that the contrary of the underlying assumption is true. Love is not the result of adequate sexual satisfaction, but sexual happiness. Even the knowledge of the so-called sexual technique is the result of love. If aside from everyday observation this thesis needed to be proved, such proof can be found in ample material of psychoanalytic data. The study of the most frequent sexual problems, frigidity in women, and the more or less severe forms of psychic impotence in men, shows that the cause does not lie in a lack of knowledge of the right technique, but in the inhibitions which make it impossible to love. Fear of or hatred for the other sex are at the bottom of those difficulties, which prevent a person from giving himself completely, from acting spontaneously, from trusting the sexual partner in the immediacy and directness of physical closeness. If a sexually inhibited person can emerge from fear or hate and hence become capable of loving, his or her sexual problems are solved. If not, no amount of knowledge about sexual techniques will help. But while the data of psychoanalytic therapy point to the fallacy of the idea that knowledge of the correct sexual technique leads to sexual happiness and love, the underlying assumption that love is the concomitant of mutual sexual satisfaction was largely influenced by the theories of Freud. For Freud, love was basically a sexual phenomenon. Man, having found by experience that sexual, genital, love afforded him his greatest gratification, so that it became in fact a prototype of all happiness to him, must have been thereby impelled to seek his happiness further along the path of sexual relations, to make genital eroticism the central point of his life. The experience of brotherly love is, for Freud, an outcome of sexual desire, but with the sexual instinct being transformed into an impulse with inhibited aim. Love with an inhibited aim was indeed originally full of sensual love, and in man's unconscious mind is so still. As far as the feeling of fusion, of oneness, oceanic feeling, which is the essence of mystical experience and the root of the most intense sense of union with one other person or with one's fellow man, is concerned, it was interpreted by Freud as a pathological phenomenon, as a regression to a state of an early limitless narcissism. It is only one step further that for Freud, love is in itself an irrational phenomenon. The difference between irrational love and love as an expression of the mature personality does not exist for him. He pointed out in a paper on transference love that transference love is essentially not different from the normal phenomenon of love. Falling in love always verges on the abnormal, is always accompanied by blindness to reality, compulsiveness, and is a transference from love objects of childhood. Love as a rational phenomenon, as the crowning achievement of maturity, was, to Freud, no subject matter for investigation, since it had no real existence. However, it would be a mistake to overestimate the influence of Freud's ideas on the concept that love is the result of sexual attraction, or rather, that it is the same as sexual satisfaction reflected in conscious feeling. Essentially, the causal nexus proceeds the other way around. Freud's ideas were partly influenced by the spirit of the 19th century. Partly, they became popular through the prevailing spirit of the years after the First World War. Some of the factors which influenced both the popular and the Freudian concepts were, first, the reaction against the strict mores of the Victorian age. The second factor determining Freud's theories lies in the prevailing concept of man, which is based on the structure of capitalism. In order to prove that capitalism corresponded to the natural needs of man, one had to show that man was by nature competitive and full of mutual hostility. While economists proved this in terms of the insatiable desire for economic gain, and the Darwinist in terms of the biological law of the survival of the fittest, Freud came to the same result by the assumption that man is driven by a limitless desire for the sexual conquest of all women, and that only the pressure of society prevented man from acting on his desires. As a result, men are necessarily jealous of each other, and this mutual jealousy and competition would continue even if all social and economic reasons for it would disappear. Eventually, Freud was largely influenced in his thinking by the type of materialism prevalent in the 19th century. One believed that the substratum of all mental phenomena was to be found in physiological phenomena. Hence, love, hate, ambition, jealousy were explained by Freud as so many outcomes of various forms of the sexual instinct. He did not see that the basic reality lies in the totality of human existence. First of all, in the human situation common to all men, and secondly, in the practice of life determined by the specific structure of society. The decisive step beyond this type of materialism was taken by Marx in his Historical Materialism, in which not the body, nor an instinct like the need for food or possession, serves as the key to the understanding of man, but the total life process of man, his practice of life. According to Freud, the full and uninhibited satisfaction of all instinctual desires would create mental health and happiness. But the obvious clinical facts demonstrate that men and women who devote their lives to unrestricted sexual satisfaction do not attain happiness, and very often suffer from severe neurotic conflicts or symptoms. The complete satisfaction of all instinctual needs is not only not a basis for happiness, it does not even guarantee sanity. Yet Freud's idea could only have become popular in the period after the First World War because of the changes which had occurred in the spirit of capitalism, from the emphasis on saving to that on spending. from self-frustration as a means for economic success to consumption as the basis for an ever-widening market and as the main satisfaction for the anxious, autonomized individual. Not to postpone the satisfaction of any desire became the main tendency in the sphere of sex as well as in that of all material consumption. It is interesting to compare the concepts of Freud, which correspond to the spirit of capitalism as it existed, yet unbroken, around the beginning of this century, with the theoretical concepts of one of the most brilliant contemporary psychoanalysts, the late H.S. Sullivan. In Sullivan's psychoanalytic system, we find, in contrast to Freud's, a strict division between sexuality and love. What is the meaning of love and intimacy in Sullivan's concept? Intimacy is that type of situation involving two people which permits validation of all components of personal worth. Validation of personal worth requires a type of relationship which I call collaboration, by which I mean clearly formulated adjustments of one's behavior to the expressed needs of the other person in pursuit of an increasingly identical, that is, more and more nearly mutual satisfactions, and in the maintenance of increasingly similar security operations. If we free Sullivan's statement from its somewhat involved language, the essence of love is seen in a situation of collaboration, in which two people feel, we play according to the rules of the game, to preserve our prestige and feeling of superiority and merit. Just as Freud's concept of love is a description of the experience of the patriarchal male in terms of 19th century capitalism, Sullivan's description refers to the experience of the alienated marketing personality of the 20th century. It is a description of an egotism à deux, of two people pooling their common interests and standing together against a hostile and alienated world. Actually, his definition of intimacy is in principle valid for the feeling of any cooperating team in which everybody adjusts his behavior to the expressed needs of the other person in the pursuit of common aims. It is remarkable that Sullivan speaks here of expressed needs, when the least one could say about love is that it implies a reaction to unexpressed needs between two people. Love as mutual sexual satisfaction and love as teamwork and as a haven from aloneness are the two normal forms of the disintegration of love in modern Western society, the socially patterned pathology of love. There are many individualized forms of the pathology of love which result in conscious suffering and which are considered neurotic by psychiatrists and an increasing number of laymen alike. Some of the more frequent ones are briefly described in the following examples. The basic condition for neurotic love lies in the fact that one or both of the lovers have remained attached to the figure of a parent and transfer the feelings, expectations, and fears one once had toward father or mother to the loved person in adult life. The persons involved have never emerged from a pattern of infantile relatedness and seek for this pattern in their affective demands in adult life. In these cases, the person has remained, effectively, a child of 2 or of 5 or of 12, while intellectually and socially he is on the level of his chronological age. In the more severe cases, this emotional immaturity leads to disturbances in his social effectiveness. In the less severe ones, the conflict is limited to the sphere of intimate personal relationships. Referring to our previous discussion of the mother or father-centered personality, the following example for this type of neurotic love relation to be found frequently today deals with men who in their emotional development have remained stuck in an infantile attachment to mother. These are men who have never been weaned, as it were, from mother. These men still feel like children. They want mother's protection, love, warmth, care, and administration. They want mother's unconditional love, a love which is given for no other reason than that they need it, that they are mother's child, that they are helpless. Such men frequently are quite affectionate and charming if they try to induce a woman to love them, and even after they have succeeded in this. But their relationship to the woman, as in fact to all other people, remains superficial and irresponsible. Their aim is to be loved, not to love. There is usually a good deal of vanity in this type of man, more or less hidden, grandiose ideas. If they have found the right woman, they feel secure, on top of the world, and can display a great deal of affection and charm. And this is the reason why these men are often so deceptive. But when, after a while, the woman does not continue to live up to their fantastic expectations, conflicts and resentment start to develop. If the woman is not always admiring them, if she makes claims for a life of her own, if she wants to be loved and protected herself, and in extreme cases, if she is not willing to condone his love affairs with other women, or even have an admiring interest in them, the man feels deeply hurt and disappointed, and usually rationalizes this feeling with the idea that the woman does not love him, is selfish, or is domineering. Anything short of the attitude of a loving mother toward a charming child is taken as proof of a lack of love. These men usually confuse their affectionate behavior, their wish to please, with genuine love, and thus arrive at the conclusion that they are being treated quite unfairly. They imagine themselves to be the great lovers and complain bitterly about the ingratitude of their love partner. In rare cases, such a mother-centered person can function without any severe disturbances. If his mother, in fact, loved him in an overprotective manner, perhaps being domineering but without being destructive, if he finds a wife of the same motherly type, if his special gifts and talents permit him to use his charm and be admired, as is the case sometimes with successful politicians, he is well-adjusted in a social sense, without ever reaching a higher level of maturity. But under less favorable conditions, and these are naturally more frequent, his love life, if not his social life, will be a serious disappointment. Conflicts and frequently intense anxiety and depression arise when this type of personality is left alone. In a still more severe form of pathology, the fixation to mother is deeper and more irrational. On this level, they wish not, symbolically speaking, to return to mother's protecting arms nor to her nourishing breast, but to her all-receiving and all-destroying womb. If the nature of sanity is to grow out of the womb into the world, the nature of severe mental disease is to be attracted by the womb, to be sucked back into it, and that is to be taken away from life. This kind of fixation usually occurs in relation to mothers who relate themselves to their children in this swallowing, destroying way. Sometimes in the name of love, sometimes of duty, they want to keep the child, the adolescent, the man, within them. He should not be able to breathe but through them, not be able to love except on a superficial sexual level, degrading all other women. He should not be able to be free and independent, but an eternal cripple or a criminal. This aspect of mother, the destructive, engulfing one, is the negative aspect of the mother figure. Mother can give life, and she can take life. She is the one to revive and the one to destroy. She can do miracles of love, and nobody can hurt more than she. In religious images, such as the Hindu goddess Kali, and in dream symbolism, the two opposite aspects of mother can often be found. A different form of neurotic pathology is to be found in such cases where the main attachment is to the father. A case in point is a man whose mother is cold and aloof, while his father, partly as a result of his wife's coldness, concentrates all his affection and interest on the son. He is a good father, but at the same time authoritarian. Whenever he is pleased with the son's conduct, he praises him, gives him presents, is affectionate. Whenever the son displeases him, he withdraws or scolds. The son, for whom father's affection is the only one he has, becomes attached to the father in a slavish way. His main aim in life is to please father, and when he succeeds, he feels happy, secure, and satisfied. But when he makes a mistake, fails, or does not succeed in pleasing father, he feels deflated, unloved, cast out. In later life, such a man will try to find a father figure to whom he attaches himself in a similar fashion. His whole life becomes a sequence of ups and downs, depending on whether he has succeeded in winning father's praise. Such men are often very successful in their social careers. They are conscientious, reliable, eager, provided their chosen father image understands how to handle them. But in their relationships to women, they remain aloof and distant. The woman is of no central significance to them. They usually have a slight contempt for her, often masked as the fatherly concern for a little girl. They may have impressed a woman initially by their masculine quality, but they become increasingly disappointing when the woman they marry discovers that she is destined to play a secondary role to the primary affection for the father figure who is prominent in the husband's life at any given time. That is, unless the wife happens to have remained attached to her father and thus is happy with a husband who relates to her as to a capricious child. More complicated is the kind of neurotic disturbance in love which is based on a different kind of parental situation, occurring when parents do not love each other, but are too restrained to quarrel or to indicate any signs of dissatisfaction outwardly. At the same time, remoteness makes them also unspontaneous in their relationship to their children. What a little girl experiences is an atmosphere of correctness, but one which never permits a close contact with either father or mother, and hence leaves the girl puzzled and afraid. She is never sure of what the parents feel or think. There is always an element of the unknown, the mysterious, in the atmosphere. As a result, the girl withdraws into a world of her own, daydreams, remains remote, and retains the same attitude in her love relationships later on. Furthermore, the withdrawal results in the development of intense anxiety, a feeling of not being firmly grounded in the world, and often leads to masochistic tendencies as the only way to experience intense excitement. Often such women would prefer having the husband make a scene and shout to his maintaining a more normal and sensible behavior, because at least it would take away the burden of tension and fear from them. Not so rarely, they unconsciously provoke such behavior in order to end the tormenting suspense of effective neutrality. Other frequent forms of irrational love are described in the following paragraphs, without going into an analysis of the specific factors in childhood development which are at their roots. A form of pseudo-love, which is not infrequent and is often experienced, and more often described in moving pictures and novels as the great love, is idolatrous love. If a person has not reached the level where he has a sense of identity, of I-ness, rooted in the productive unfolding of his own powers, he tends to idolize the loved person. He is alienated from his own powers and projects them into the loved person, who is worshipped as the summum bonum, the bearer of all love, all light, all bliss. In this process, he deprives himself of all sense of strength, loses himself in the loved one instead of finding himself. Since usually no person can, in the long run, live up to the expectations of her or his idolatrous worshiper, disappointment is bound to occur, and as a remedy, a new idol is sought for, sometimes in an unending circle. What is characteristic for this type of idolatrous love is, at the beginning, the intensity and suddenness of the love experience. This idolatrous love is often described as the true great love, but while it is meant to portray the intensity and depth of love, it only demonstrates the hunger and despair of the idolater. Needless to say, it is not rare that two persons find each other in a mutual idolatry, which sometimes, in extreme cases, represents the picture of a folie à deux. Another form of pseudo-love is what may be called sentimental love. Its essence lies in the fact that love is experienced only in fantasy and not in the here-and-now relationship to another person who is real. The most widespread form of this type of love is that to be found in the vicarious love satisfaction experienced by the consumer of screen pictures, magazine love stories, and love songs. All the unfulfilled desires for love, union, and closeness find their satisfaction in the consumption of these products. A man and a woman who, in relation to their spouses, are incapable of ever penetrating the walls of separateness are moved to tears when they participate in the happy or unhappy love story of the couple on the screen. For many couples, seeing these stories on the screen is the only occasion on which they experience love, not for each other, but together as spectators of other people's love. As long as love is a daydream, they can participate. As soon as it comes down to the reality of the relationship between two real people, they are frozen. Another aspect of sentimental love is the abstractification of love in terms of time. A couple may be deeply moved by memories of their past love, although when this past was present, no love was experienced, or the fantasies of their future love. How many engaged or newly married couples dream of their bliss of love to take place in the future, while at the very moment at which they live, they are already beginning to be bored with each other? This tendency coincides with a general attitude characteristic of modern man. He lives in the past or in the future, but not in the present. He remembers sentimentally his childhood and his mother, or he makes happy plans for the future. Whether love is experienced vicariously by participating in the fictitious experiences of others, or whether it is shifted away from the present to the past or the future, this abstractified and alienated form of love serves as an opiate which alleviates the pain of reality, the aloneness and separateness of the individual. Still another form of neurotic love lies in the use of projective mechanisms for the purpose of avoiding one's own problems and being concerned with the defects and frailties of the loved person instead. Individuals behave in this respect very much as groups, nations, or religions do. They have a fine appreciation for even the minor shortcomings of the other person and go blissfully ahead ignoring their own, always busy trying to accuse or to reform the other person. If two people both do it, as is so often the case, the relationship of love becomes transformed into one of mutual projection. If I am domineering or indecisive or greedy, I accuse my partner of it, and depending on my character, I either want to cure him or to punish him. The other person does the same, and both thus succeed in ignoring their own problems and hence fail to undertake any steps which would help them in their own development. Another form of projection is the projection of one's own problems on the children. First of all, such projection takes place not infrequently in the wish for children. In such cases, the wish for children is primarily determined by projecting one's own problem of existence on that of the children. When a person feels that he has not been able to make sense of his own life, he tries to make sense of it in terms of the life of his children. But one is bound to fail within oneself and for the children. The former, because the problem of existence can be solved by each one only for himself and not by proxy. The latter because one lacks the very qualities which one needs to guide the children in their own search for an answer. Children serve for projective purposes also when the question arises of dissolving an unhappy marriage. The stock argument of parents in such a situation is that they cannot separate in order not to deprive the children of the blessing of a unified home. Any detailed study would show, however, that the atmosphere of tension and unhappiness within the unified family is more harmful to the children than an open break would be, which teaches them at least that man is able to end an intolerable situation by a courageous decision. One other frequent error must be mentioned here. The illusion, namely, that love means necessarily the absence of conflict. Just as it is customary for people to believe that pain and sadness should be avoided under all circumstances, they believe that love means the absence of any conflict, and they find good reasons for this idea in the fact that the struggles around them seem only to be destructive interchanges which bring no good to either one of those concerned. But the reason for this lies in the fact that the conflicts of most people are actually attempts to avoid the real conflicts. They are disagreements on minor or superficial matters which by their very nature do not lend themselves to clarification or solution. Real conflicts between two people, those which do not serve to cover up or to project, but which are experienced on the deep level of inner reality to which they belong, are not destructive. They lead to clarification. They produce a catharsis from which both persons emerge with more knowledge and more strength. This leads us to emphasize again something said above. Love is possible only if two persons communicate with each other from the center of their existence. Hence, if each one of them experiences himself from the center of his existence. Only in this central experience is human reality. Only here is aliveness. Only here is the basis for love. Love, experienced thus, is a constant challenge. It is not a resting place, but a moving, growing, working together. Even whether there is harmony or conflict, joy or sadness, is secondary to the fundamental fact that two people experience themselves from the essence of their existence, that they are one with each other by being one with themselves, rather than by fleeing from themselves. There is only one proof for the presence of love, the depth of the relationship, and the aliveness and strength in each person concerned. This is the fruit by which love is recognized. Just as automatons cannot love each other, they cannot love God. The disintegration of the love of God has reached the same proportions as the disintegration of the love of man. This fact is in blatant contradiction to the idea that we are witnessing a religious renaissance in this epoch. Nothing could be further from the truth. What we witness, even though there are exceptions, is a regression to an idolatric concept of God and a transformation of the love of God into a relationship fitting an alienated character structure. The regression to an idolatric concept of God is easy to see. People are anxious, without principles or faith. They find themselves without an aim except the one to move ahead. Hence, they continue to remain children, to hope for father or mother to come to their help when help is needed. True, in religious cultures like that of the Middle Ages, the average man also looked to God as to a helping father and mother. But at the same time, he took God seriously also, in the sense that the paramount goal of his life was to live according to God's principles, to make salvation the supreme concern to which all other activities were subordinated. Today, nothing of such effort is present. Daily life is strictly separated from any religious values. It is devoted to the striving for material comforts, for the success on the personality market. The principles on which our secular efforts are built are those of indifference and egotism, the latter often labeled as individualism or individual initiative. Man of truly religious cultures may be compared with children at the age of 8 who need father as a helper, but who begin to adopt his teachings and principles in their lives. Contemporary man is rather like a child of 3 who cries for father when he needs him and otherwise is quite self-sufficient when he can play. In this respect, in the infantile dependence on the anthropomorphic picture of God without the transformation of life according to the principles of God, we are closer to a primitive idolatric tribe than to the religious culture of the Middle Ages. In another respect, our religious situation shows features which are new and characteristic only of contemporary Western capitalistic society. I can refer to statements made in a previous part of this book. Modern man has transformed himself into a commodity. He experiences his life energy as an investment with which he should make the highest profit, considering his position and the situation on the personality market. He is alienated from himself, from his fellow man, and from nature. His main aim is profitable exchange of his skills, knowledge, and of himself, his personality package with others who are equally intent on a fair and profitable exchange. Life has no goal except the one to move, no principle except the one of fair exchange, no satisfaction except the one to consume. What can the concept of God mean under these circumstances? It is transformed from its original religious meaning into one fitting the alienated culture of success. In the religious revival of recent times, the belief in God has been transformed into a psychological device to make one better fitted for the competitive struggle. Religion allies itself with autosuggestion and psychotherapy to help man in his business activities. In the 20s, one had not yet called upon God for purposes of improving one's personality. The bestseller in the year 1938, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, remained on a strictly secular level. What was the function of Carnegie's book at the time is the function of our greatest bestseller today, The Power of Positive Thinking by the Reverend N.V. Peale. In this religious book, it is not even questioned whether our dominant concern with success is in itself in accordance with the spirit of monotheistic religion. On the contrary, the supreme aim is never doubted, but belief in God and prayer is recommended as a means to increase one's ability to be successful. Just as modern psychiatrists recommend happiness of the employee in order to be more appealing to the customers, some ministers recommend love of God in order to be more successful. Make God your partner means to make God a partner in business, rather than to become one with Him in love, justice, and truth. Just as brotherly love has been replaced by impersonal fairness, God has been transformed into a remote general director of Universe Incorporated. You know that He is there, He runs the show, although it would probably run without Him too. You never see Him, but you acknowledge His leadership while you are doing your part.